Yet the man lives to be 147 years old. Can a man's life be summed up in 10 chapters when you live to be 147 years of age? Obviously, this is a condensed version of what was a very difficult life as a sheep herder in a desert community as he wandered around looking for pasture lands for his flocks throughout. But 10 chapters occupy this. His name is Jacob, Yaakov. He's a significant patriarch. Later on, his name will be changed to Israel, which means he struggles with God. The name change will be a pivotal turning point in his spiritual journey. But it brings to mind, how many times have you and I struggled with God? How many of us have struggled to understand, why is this pandemic going on? And why now? And what are we supposed to be learning from it? Are you struggling? Because ultimately, if we struggle against the circumstances God allows in our lives, we're struggling against God. We might be named Israel as well. That's where the present-day country of Israel got its name. It's from Jacob, whose name was changed to he struggles with God. Jacob, as we start this chapter, according to many reputable scholars, they pin his age down plus or minus of 75 years old. What a time to get started on your spiritual journey. But didn't Abraham do exactly the same thing? Hadn't Moses spent 40 years in Pharaoh's court and then 40 years in the desert, and so he gets a legitimate start in ministry at 80 years of age? While the world may belong to the young, the wisdom resides in the heart of the older folks that are out there. And I think our younger audience could do well to learn humbly from those that have walked far longer than they have in their Christian journey. About 75 years old when he takes off on his journey to Paddan Aram, which is today northwest Iraq. He lives to be 147. He's going to spend 20-plus years there and then come back when he's about 95 years of age. That gives me a tremendous sense of anticipation for what lies ahead. I'm a youthful young man compared to this patriarch. I'm nowhere near 95 years of age, but to know that his best years are ahead of him make me wonder if my best years are not ahead of me. Are your best years ahead of you? Don't look back on the glory days when you were 30 or 35 and could whoop lions with one hand but behind your back. If you didn't have enough sense to hand wrestle a lion, you probably deserved the whooping you got. However, as you get older, you say, why don't we just stay away from lions altogether? There's wisdom to be learned in that. Jacob had, in the last chapter, a powerful personal encounter with God at Bethel. You remember that back in chapter 28 and verse 16? He said, God was in this place, and I didn't know it. Can I tell you, God is in this place, though the auditorium is empty. God is in this place. God is with you this very moment as you're watching this live stream or watching it on your phone or your computer or tablet. God is with you every bit as much as he was with this patriarch. And this patriarch had no idea what lay ahead in his future other than the blessings that his father Isaac had pronounced on him. You and I have no idea of what lies ahead in our future. But I can tell you this, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. Hang on to that. Jesus Christ is coming soon for his church. And everything between now and then is preparation for ruling and reigning with him for 1,000 years over this fallen world. When Jacob gets to Haran, a journey of somewhere around 500 miles plus or minus from Beersheba to Haran, it probably took the better part of 2 months to get there walking through the desert, which gives you plenty of time to think about who you are, what you are, where you're going, and what got you here. He had tried to hoodwink blessings out of his brother. He'd taken his firstborn rights. He'd taken his inheritance rights. He had pretty much robbed his brother of everything through deception and conniving, despite the fact that God had promised him that the older would be a servant to the younger. But that doesn't mean you have to make it happen yourself or take things into your own hands. So as he's going there, God, I believe, is preparing him for what lies ahead. He still has an old nature. Don't you wish when you and I got saved and had a meaningful encounter with God as Jacob had in his dream at Bethel? Wouldn't it be cool if you never had to sin again? If you never had another temptation, another test, another failure? Wouldn't it be great if you could say, I'm walking in the Spirit 100% now and I'm never going to mess up again? We make that commitment, but we sometimes stumble and fall. We don't mean to. And I think that maybe desert experiences where you've got some peace and quiet, or coronaviruses that keep you locked up at home and away from sports and entertainment and the bars and the dance clubs and whatever else, maybe God has given us that opportunity so we can have the same kind of Bethel experience that Jacob did. I fear that many of us are not going to take advantage of the moment. If you're not reading more than you did a month ago today, you're doing something wrong. If you're not more at peace today than you were a month ago, then you've missed grabbing hold of the hem of his garment. God has given us a wonderful opportunity to deliver us from the busyness of life in America in the 21st century. And yet some of us have not availed ourselves to that. And we still hide behind the mantle of presupposed busyness or I've got to do this or take care of that. Well, what God has in store for Jacob remains to be seen. But I can tell you this, in the short story, what goes around comes around. He has been a deceiver the better part of his 75, 85 years. And he is about to run into a deceiver that is the deceiver of all deceivers. No, it's not Satan. It's his own uncle, a guy by the name of Laban. Winds up working for the guy for 18 years, being taken advantage of, basically, because he doesn't get paid other than the food that goes in his mouth. 7 years he works so he can be betrothed to Rachel, but when the deceiver Laban substitutes his older daughter Leah, he works for another 7 years so he can have the girl that he went there to get. Finally, another 4 years for the livestock he acquires. And that brings us up to the text, having painted that background in verse 1 of chapter 29 of Genesis. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples, and there he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all of the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll away the stone from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Verse 1 is, I love, not only because Jacob reminds me that his name is he grasps the heel, which becomes synonymous later on with supplanter or deceiver. He had taken his brother's place. He had supplanted his brother, fleeing from Esau now. And now he's looking for a bride. This change in purpose was due to God's promise given him at Bethel. There was going to be a lot of descendants that come out of him. He has no idea of what that means. But it says in verse 1 there, notice it says he continued on his journey. That's not exactly what the Hebrew says. In the original language, it says literally, he lifted up his feet. And you go, well, that's a curious picture. Not if you're Hebrew. It means, well, let's put it in our vernacular. There was a bounce in his step. He's met with God, and so he's continuing his journey now, but he's got a bounce in his step. He lifted up his feet. An encounter with God, who is the giver and source of all joy and happiness, manifests itself in a changed walk. There's something different. There's more joy. There's more purpose. When we have a meaningful encounter with God, we should have that every day. He's got a bounce in his step. To quote the movie about the penguins, he now has happy feet. He's just with his feet. He's a happy camper. He's literally enthusiastic. A fascinating Greek word borrowed out of the New Testament, which is fascinating in its origins. Entheos is the original Greek term. It means literally in God. You are at your best when you're in God. You are the most enthusiastic, the most joyful, the most fulfilled, the most contented when you are enthusiastic, when you're in God. Jacob has a new outlook. Happens to us every time we get in the presence of God. He had a personal encounter with God, and it changes us all when we do that. If you haven't met God powerfully today, good news. There's yet 6.5 hours in this day. You've got time to get on your face with the Bible in a quiet place. Shut the door behind you. If your private room winds up being your bedroom or the dining room or the bathroom, it doesn't matter. But spend some time with God, because you and I, above all else in this life, need a personal encounter with God if we're going to get through life, whether it's a coronavirus pandemic or whatever else is on down the road. I want to be prepared for that. But if you haven't had a personal encounter today, you've still got time. Make wise use of that time. It changes us when it happens. Verse 2, it reminds me as well, significantly, Jacob's meeting of Rachel parallels his father's meeting of Rebekah. Remember that back in chapter 24? Certainly, Laban, Rebekah's brother, would have remembered how God had led Eliezer. God's sovereignly arranged coincidences, if you will, are found throughout these chapters of how God arranges simple circumstances in our lives in ways that we could not have anticipated. He happens upon a spot where there's a well. He just happens to be near Haran. He just happens to be close to where Laban is. Let's continue reading the text in verse 4. As the shepherds come, verse 4, Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran." Another coincidence? Or is this God weaving together the pieces of the puzzle of our lives? Do you believe in the sovereignty of God? That means He controls every footstep you take, every job you have, every coincidence, every circumstance, every happenstance, including this stay-at-home order that we're under because of the virus. God's in charge of that. He has reasons and purposes for having done that that we couldn't only begin to comprehend, but purposes that we can acquire personally. What's God trying to teach you in this? Maybe you need to grow a little bit in patience. I certainly do. Maybe you need to learn to trust Him more. I can't go out and find entertainment. You can find God. Entertainment will come back up soon enough. Don't worry about that. God has quashed every idol America worships, whether it's sports or entertainment or bars, dance joints, you name it. He's closed it all down so that we can focus on Him. And He said to them, do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson? Verse 5, yes, we know him. Oh, that's a happy coincidence, isn't it? God ordains coincidences like this. Verse 6, then Jacob asked him, is he well? Yes, he is, they said. Here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep. Another fortuitous circumstance? Or is this a divine appointment? If you believe in the sovereignty of God, you must say this is a divine appointment. Look, he said, the sun is still high. It's not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to the pasture. And they said in verse 8, we can't, they replied, until all of the flocks are gathered and the stone has to be rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep. We got to gather them all up first, because it's a big, huge, heavy stone. And we don't want to do this more than once. So when all the flocks are gathered, then we do that. Then we'll take them back out to pasture. And while he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. And you're thinking, this is pretty weird. Who goes up and kisses a strange chick? In the Middle East, men do that. They bow the head to each other and do an air kiss on either side, whether men or women. And so he does that. It's a polite greeting. But then the weeping aloud, we'll talk about that here in just a second. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah, so she ran and told her father. verse 10. I love verse 10 because it happens so often at my house. When Jacob sees this pretty little thing, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and his sheep, he goes over and rolls the stone away. Nothing, a man does not like anything better than being asked to flex his muscles and show off for his little woman. Trying to impress the girls, that's what he's doing here. It's like the old John Wayne swagger, well, let me get that for you there, little lady. You know, the guys just like that. Just you ask them to step up. My wife does that to me all the time. She appeals to that sense of maleness about us. Oh, honey, she says, you're so big and strong. Would you do this for me? Well, just let me take care of that for you there, little woman. And then she bats her eyes at me, and it's a done deal. She reads me like a book, and she knows if you stroke the man just a little bit, if you give him an attaboy, he'll pretty much do anything for you. On the other hand, how do men generally respond to nagging? Have you ladies found that effective in your home? Not the way to do that. Appeal to the sense that he is your male covering, your big, strong provider and protector. It's not that any of us do a perfect job of that, but you appeal to him and say, honey, you're so big and you're so strong. Would you take care of this for me? I do it myself, but you're so much bigger and stronger than I. Honey, would you reach that thing up on the top shelf? I can't quite reach it. And a man just aches to do that for his significant other. When Kathy does that to me, she can consider it done. Honey, would you wash the entire house on the outside, please, honey? You're so big and strong, you could do it. I'll go, you betcha, I can do it. I can do all things. Verse 11, what is this? He wept aloud. Did he weep for joy? Is he just an emotional guy? Or is he perhaps overwhelmed by God's answer to prayer? He realizes God has played a part in guiding his very footsteps to this very well and happening to meet this pretty lady right up front. What I find consistently in the verses that follow is a biblical demonstration of the principle that you reap what you sow. That's a quote found out of Galatians 6 and verse 7. Look at verse 13. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him, and he embraced him and kissed him. That's what they do in the Middle East. It's a cultural thing to the present day. You've seen them do it on TV. They do that in the Middle East. It's tantamount to a handshake here, but more polite and personal. And there Jacob told him all of these things, and Laban said to him, you're my own flesh and blood. Oh, he sounds like such a wonderful uncle. Wish I had met you before. He may regret that a little bit later on. After Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, just because you're a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. In other words, he'd been helping out. That's just hospitality. If you're going to eat somebody's food and stay under their roof for a while, you want to help out with the chores. You don't want to be lazy and watch everybody else do the work, pitch in, do some dishes, cook a meal, you know, take care of things. Verse 16, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. And Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. They're contrasted with each other. So we'll talk about that here in just a second. Verse 18, Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you for 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Put yourself in a Middle Eastern mindset where you've got flocks and cows and goats and sheep and donkeys and camels and things like that. He names his oldest daughter, Leah, cow. Specifically, and more politely, heifer. Who calls a woman a heifer? In the Middle East, maybe. What do you mean? A heifer is a kind term. It's an unbred cow under the age of three. And his other daughter's name, Rachel, means little lamb. Now, these are appropriate names if you come from a long line of sheep herders and herdsmen of all sorts of flocks. These are appropriate names. These are not derogatory names at all. They're very complimentary. At least in the Middle East. I know you're thinking like, well, I live in Colorado. I don't quite get that. That's okay. Don't name your kids cow. Wouldn't encourage you to do that. Women generally don't like to be called heifers, so I encourage you to stay away from that. My little lamb. Okay, well, we're moving in the right direction, but still, this is a Middle Eastern thing, and without putting on your yarmulke and thinking in Middle Eastern terms, you may miss the gravity of what's being said here. Verse 17, I know you have a question about this because I sure did. Leah had weak eyes, but in contrast, is how the sentence is set up in the original language, In contrast, Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Leah had weak eyes. Did she have eyesight problems? The word literally means delicate, soft, or tender. Now, what does it mean to have delicate or tender eyes? Well, the Hebrew root is rakak, but it's been suggested by some. Perhaps she had blue eyes in a culture that was dominated by dark brown eyes. Thus, her eyes were seen as weaker. That's a possibility. Others say that her soft eyes were her best feature, but Rachel was the more attractive of the two. That could well be, and that's the kind of the gist of the meaning I had, because they're in contrast to one another. She had soft eyes, delicate eyes, tender eyes. Her eyes were her best feature, but she couldn't hold a candle to her sister's physical beauty, and I want to talk about that. There are two kinds of beauty in this world. There is spiritual beauty and there is physical beauty. You should strive for spiritual beauty. The outward is perishing, it's passing away, and it changes as we get older, regardless of how many hours you spend in the gym. What the Bible advocates is that we become spiritual women, like Sarah was. Peter describes a woman who's not known by her outward adornment, but by her gentle and quiet spirit. Okay? So don't obsess like America does with the outward form as much as pursuing inward beauty. Does that just make sense? Which do you think is more important in God's eyes? If you focus on the outward beauty, all you're going to do is appeal to the flesh of men. What you want to be is a spiritual woman who is known for her spirituality, whether she has weak eyes or she's lovely and attractive in form. What I find as we read further in the following chapters is that Leah has much more spiritual beauty than her gorgeous sister has. Much deeper walk with the Lord, and we'll see a bit of that even in this chapter. So as we continue on there, verse 19, Laban said, well, it's better I give my younger daughter to you than to some other man. Stay here with me. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, this beautiful young lady, but they seemed only like a few days to him because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her. In other words, it's time to be married. I want to be betrothed to her. I want to go on the honeymoon thing. I want to do the whole thing. He served her for 7 years, and ranching and herding and being a shepherd is hard work in a desert environment, most especially. This sounds so romantic. Give me my wife. I want to lie with her. Verse 22, so Laban brought together all of the people of the place, gave a feast. The wedding was consummated. Everybody had a little too much wine to drink. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. Middle Eastern culture has you covered head to toe before you go into the tent where the marriage is consummated. So it's pitch black. And he has no idea who's in bed with him. He assumes it's Leah. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as a maidservant. When morning came, there was Leah. Maybe a little less wine would have been appropriate and helped in the area of discernment. Just saying. So there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what's this you've done to me? I've served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? The deceiver meets his match in his deceptive uncle. You reap what you sow. What goes around comes around. Now, I don't want to take away from the romance of this passage, but looking at, once again at verse 20, you have to understand Jacob at this time is over 70 years of age. I mean, he lives to be 147, so he's kind of middle-aged, but what this tells me, guys, take note of this. You're never too old to be romantic. Okay? He may be 75 years of age, but he's a romancing kind of fool. He is romancing this little sweetheart, and serving 7 years for is a piece of cake. Guys, listen up. You you were romantic when you were dating your wife, and then you got married, and somehow or another, somebody turned off the romance button. You courted her, and then you got married, and you stopped courting her. You dated her before you got married, and now you got married. You don't date anymore. You don't go out anymore and have fun. It's just work as usual, food and clothing and kids and school and whatever else is going on. But Gaius, can I tell you what all your wives want is a little romance? Be romantic. You're never too old to be romantic. Jacob had such a great love for her that 7 years seemed but a few days. It reminds me of 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, starting in verse 4, where love is described. And this is how we should treat our wives, guys. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always persevere. Love never fails. That's how husbands should love their wives. That's how wives should love their husbands. But all along, Laban has been scheming there in verses 23 to 27, knowing all along he was going to give his less attractive daughter to him instead. It was a setup, despite the fact that Jacob had worked for 7 years. Good grief. And yet his own uncle deceives him to this extent. Laban replied in verse 26, "Hey, it's not our custom around here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, and we'll give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work." What a con job. What a con job. What he says in verse 26, it's not our custom to give the younger before the firstborn, literally it says. You know, that's exactly what Jacob had done to the firstborn in his family, wasn't it? He took advantage of his brother Esau, took from him the rights as firstborn. Galatians 6:7, whatever you sow, that also shall you reap. Verse 27, the 7 years' work for each daughter was kind of a dowry paid to Laban. By Jacob. Weeks of years is a unique Hebrew way of describing things. Notice this in verse 27. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. So we understand that it is a week of years. And that's kind of foreign to us, but very common in Hebrew literature. But the most prominent example of this is in Daniel chapter 9 in verses 25 and following, where that same terminology of weeks to represent years is given. Daniel 9:25, "No one understand this from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one comes. There will be seven sevens," literally 7 weeks, 7 weeks of years, "and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble." After the 62 sevens, the week, 62 weeks of years are over, the anointed one will come and will be cut off and have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He, that is the Antichrist, will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7, literally a 7 year period, a week of years. This is a very Hebrew thing that is not common to our language or culture, but I'm trying to get you to understand that a Hebrew would have understood this readily. A week of years is, he's asking me for another 7 years of servanthood, but when you get to Daniel, you understand we're talking about a final 7 year period in Earth's history where at some point in time in the future, the Antichrist is going to rule over the nations of this world. A 7 year period. that would have been readily understood in Daniel's culture and time amongst the Hebrew population. In the middle of the seven, Daniel continues, the Antichrist will put an end to sacrifice and offering. That tells you the temple will be rebuilt, but we may not be here to see that. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out upon him. Some say that was fulfilled when Antiochus Epiphanes in 167 slaughtered a pig on the altar in the temple. Here's the problem with that. Jesus in Matthew's gospel talked about it as a yet future event. As he talks about it in Matthew chapter 24, the desolation that is caused was yet future. It was not entirely fulfilled in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes the IV. So this would have been a very natural Hebrew way of taking the passage. A week of years is simply 7 years. That's what Laban alludes to in verse 27. Verse 28, then Jacob did so. He completed the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maidservant. So Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked for Laban for another 7 years. Verse 31. Doesn't the favoritism break your heart already? Leah is the more spiritual, but just because her younger sister is the better looking, she has the affections of Jacob, and she is somewhat neglected herself and loved less. And Jacob made his preference of Rachel over Leah obvious. And you're going to see in the following passages the issues, the problem, the fruit of polygamy in a family. In the line of Jacob, you've got these two wives and their two handmaidens, and Jacob will wind up sleeping with all of them. We'll look at that a little bit later on in subsequent chapters. But what is the fruit of polygamy? Once again, it doesn't represent the perfect will of God as seen in Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, one man, one woman for life. But when there is polygamy, what you're going to see here in subsequent chapters and in this one to begin, you're going to see rivalry, hatred, envy, anger, fighting, and sexual bribery. That doesn't sound very spiritually mature, does it? But we'll see that. So in verse 31, when the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. God sees the injustice and blesses Leah. I think by far she is the more godly of the two sisters. And we'll see that in the naming of her children. But Leah makes the classic mistake of thinking a baby would bring her and Jacob together. I've counseled people before like that. Well, our marriage is falling apart, and I know if I'll have a baby, things will be better. It just makes things worse and more complicated. But there is that innate desire, I think, in most women to have children of their own. Verse 32, Leah became pregnant, gave birth to a son, and she named him Reuben. For she said, it is because the Lord has seen my misery. Reuben literally in Hebrew means, wow, look, a son. It's a good name. Verse 33, she conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, because the Lord heard me and knows that I am not loved, he gave me this one too, so she named him Simeon, one who hears. God has heard my prayers, in other words. And again, she conceived and gave birth to a son and said, now at last my husband will become attached to me. Wrong thinking, though a godly woman, because I have borne him three sons, so she named him Levi. Levi means joined or attached. My husband will become attached to me, was her hope and prayer. Verse 35, she conceived again. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, this time I will praise the Lord. I will praise the Lord. Loved or unloved, I'm going to praise the Lord. And so she named him Judah, which means what? Praise. Praise. Then she stopped having children. Did you notice throughout the passage the weight of the circumstances that God moves in and how God moves. Did you notice, for instance, that Well, the coincidence we touched on briefly, Jacob just happens to meet shepherds outside the town of Ram. They just happen to know Laban. Rachel just happens to be coming by the well when Jacob is still talking. She just happens to be unmarried and available. But what stands out to me more is in the first 30 verses of chapter 29, there is no mention of God whatsoever. No mention of his sacred name, Yahweh, in the first 30 verses. It should cause you to ask why. Again, let me encourage you to think like a Hebrew here. It's a very common Hebrew poetic device. Make something conspicuous by its absence. God is not seen on the front of it, his name not overtly mentioned, but he is weaving together all of these circumstances. God is ever present, though unseen, dearest friends. Understand that. So he is conspicuously absent by name, but conspicuously present by the details and circumstances that he's weaving together in the lives of these people mentioned. God's presence is implied, for sure, but most often, God's leading and guiding is through our circumstances. Whether good or bad, that's why in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 it says, all things work together for the good of those that love God and are called according to his purposes. That's you and I. So while things may look bad on the surface, God has a reason, he's got a plan, he's got a purpose that you and I don't have to understand. You just got to go with God. Let him be God. Don't tell him his business. Don't see these things as coincidences that just happenstance brought around. Sometimes God works in very subtle ways. Most often he does. The Bible says God moves in mysterious ways. Well, that's for sure. But he moves in our circumstances, the situations that we find ourselves in. Don't forget the faithful promise of God in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart and do not lean upon your own understanding. Don't try to figure out what God's doing. Stop that. In all of your ways, acknowledge him and he will direct your path. He will make your path straight. He knows what he's doing and he knows how to get you from point A to point B. But I also see in this chapter the deceiver Jacob is bested by another deceiver, his own uncle Laban. And that's where the saying comes from. What goes around comes around. God can send someone our way who is better at our sin than we are. If we make it a habit to take advantage of others, for instance, God may very well send someone our way who will take advantage of us just to teach us a lesson. You reap what you sow. Didn't Jesus say in what some call the golden rule, do to others what you would have them do to you? That's his standard. Do what's right. Don't deceive, don't cheat, don't steal, don't lie. But what I see at the close of this chapter from verses 31 to 35 especially is Leah's godliness is simply stellar. She has a strong and enduring faith that her sister, despite her beauty, does not possess. And I look at her faith. I look at how God blesses her. Understand that the first four tribes of Israel are born from Leah. She is God's choice. Maybe not Jacob's, but she is God's choice. She gives birth to Levi, the ancestor of Aaron, the father of all of the priests that would come from that. She is the mother, ultimately, of Judah, through whom comes Jesus Christ, as well as Reuben, who is Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Jacob's secondborn. Look at how she sees the hand of God in the blessing of her children. She names them thankful for what God has done and acknowledging that. Notice what she names her children. These are wonderful names, not related to shepherding or raising sheep or goats or donkeys or animals like they had been named. She says God's at work in this. So she gives her children names that refer to God working in and through her circumstances. And note, Notice that while her marriage is a source of pain and discouragement, she never gives up on Jacob, and she never gives up on God. Life is hard. We are sinful, fallen people, married to sinful, fallen people. And the best of us is a hot mess at times. And I think that we should ask the forgiveness of our spouses often. But don't let the bitterness of life make you bitter towards God. Guard your heart against that. Her marriage, the closest of all relationships, is a source of pain, a source of discouragement. What does she do? She doesn't give up. She doesn't throw in the towel. She doesn't lambast her husband or make life a living hell for him by way of retribution. She doesn't give up on her husband, but more importantly, she doesn't give up on God. That's chapter 29 in a nutshell. Read ahead. Chapter 30, this just gets better and better and better. But these are some of the life's lessons that God intends for you and I to learn tonight. Life has always been difficult. It always has been. God knows what he's doing. He loves you. He's going to take care of you. Trust him. He's got a track record that takes us back to the first book of the Bible. He's a faithful God. This is all going to turn out just fine. I promise you, everything in your life and mine will turn out just fine in the long run if we just keep our eyes on him. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart and do not lean upon your own understanding, but in all of your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your paths. Father, thank you for the word that encourages us in a godly direction. Thank you for the promises that we can claim on a daily basis, even when life seems to be spiraling out of control. You've reminded us that you're the God of those things. You've got reasons, plans, and purposes that no enemy of ours, spiritual or otherwise, can thwart.